What is up, movie friends? Welcome back to the show. I'm Anthony.
And this is James, and today we're doing Harry Potter and the Sorcerer's Stone. We did a Harry Potter episode going over every movie. We also did a Harry Potter villains episode, but we're going to go individually with one film a week per episode, and it's going to be a blast. And I love Harry Potter and the Sorcerer's Stone, a.k.a. the Philosopher's Stone, depending on whatever part of the world you're living in.
We love these movies and these books because we were the same ages as the actors. We really related to the movies, and this was the biggest pop culture phenomenon of our generation, hands down. I mean, when these books were coming out, every kid was reading them. Like, and it's an amazing thing that J.K. Rowling wrote dense books, some of them 700 pages, 800 pages, and little kids were clamoring to read them from front to back as quickly as they could. I can't think of anything that's ever happened that can compare to that.
Yeah, we grew up with these characters film-wise and also the books. We had no idea what the heck Harry Potter was until our aunt got us the Sorcerer's Stone as a birthday present, I think like on our 9th birthday. I'd never heard of it before.
I remember in one of my classes in elementary school, a student brought it in for show and tell, and he passed the book around, and I remember looking at the cover like so curiously, like, what is this?
Yeah, because it's Harry on a broom, and there's like
the stone's flying in the air.
Yeah, the cool thing about the books is the entire pamphlet page of the book is like one work of art when you pull it apart.
Yeah, it's like a widescreen image.
It's really cool. But this film had a budget of $125 million, and it grossed $1 billion worldwide. And in 2001, that's a pretty big deal. And, I mean, Titanic did that around a year before, or was that 1999?
Yeah, but also, I mean, this is a billion-dollar movie led by kids.
Like,
11-year-olds are in this movie. That's never happened before. And the fact that, like, this is a property that no one really knew about in America until the first two books came out, because the UK knew about the books for a couple of years before we got them, so they already knew what's up. But for us, the books came out in America, and then the movie was in production pretty quickly, so it all happened very quickly for us.
Yeah, American kids, we were, like, obsessed with Pokemon at this time. Like, 99, 2000, 2001, Pokemon was the thing, and then Harry Potter came and also took our lives by storm with that. And the Sorcerer's Stone, it sets the stage for easily one of the greatest stories ever told in fiction literature and in film. And the way that Chris Columbus just kind of sets the franchise up visually and aesthetically with the franchise for films, it's so incredible what he did. I mean, if anyone's unfamiliar, Chris Columbus, he wrote Gremlins in 1984. That was his first like big break, you could say. He didn't direct it, though. But he did direct Home Alone, Mrs. Doubtfire, and Bicentennial Man, and he did Sorcerer's Stone and Chamber of Secrets.
I think he did Home Alone 2 as well.
Yeah, he did the Home Alone franchise.
So he's always worked in the family movie realm genres. Like, after Harry Potter's, he did the Percy Jackson franchise. And that's his strength, telling these stories with young people in it. And they needed someone like Columbus because J.K. wanted, originally her first choice was Terry Gilliam, who would have been an awesome choice as a fantastic director. And he would have made something really special, I'm sure. But the fact that he might have taken too much of a creative twist with it, maybe, because his movies can be very out there in their own right. Whereas Chris Columbus, I think the reason why he was the perfect director was because he was so loyal to the books. He was so loyal to the world that they built. And he seemed to be able to connect to the young audiences in a great way. I mean, this is a 2.5-hour movie, and kids sat down with their butts in the seats, and we were just transfixed by it.
Before we continue, the best way to support Raiders of the Lost Podcast is to become a patron at patreon.com/Raiders of the Lost Podcast. Patrons get perks like personalized messages, personalized video messages, podcast schedules. Top-tier patrons get a monthly shout-out on the podcast. And you'll also have access to exclusive video content and patron-only giveaways. We just did a hat giveaway a couple weeks ago. Caitlin Signorelli won that, so we do that with only patrons. Head on over to our website, Raiders of the Lost Podcast, to check out all of our sources of content, our merch, our custom movie posters, and become a patron there today. Be sure to follow on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, wherever you're listening. Hit the notification bell. If you're watching on YouTube, hit the subscribe button and smash that like button. Yeah, I think the greatest strength to the films, besides production design and set design and acting and the cast and everything, is Chris Columbus really created this really great like medieval aesthetic and kind of a classic filmic aesthetic, which sort of obviously gets modernized with Prisoner of Azkaban with Alfonso Cuarón, and we see the tonal shift with the franchise. But I love this, like, medieval vibe so much, and like, we get the Wizarding World and Hogwarts Castle, and it's so relatable because Chris Columbus grounded it for us in our world to make it seem like we could be part of it, and then throw in John Williams' score, which has, like, the medieval castle qualities with, like, all the horns and brass and French horns and trumpets, and it's just such a fun aesthetic, I think, with that medieval vibe.
It's a great point you brought up Azkaban with Qaron, because that was such, like you said, a change in tone. And he wouldn't have been able to do that if it weren't for Chris Columbus setting the stage with the first two films. Yes, they're a little more family-friendly. Yes, the cinematography is not very
artistic.
They still did a beautiful job with the film.
Everything's well-lit.
Yeah, everything's well-lit. They kind of played it safe in terms of the visual imagery of it. And there are some darker tones of the film that they kind of didn't put in darker tones to the books they didn't put into the movie itself. But I think that you had to start off with the movie the way Chris Columbus made it in order to set the stage for the entire franchise.
Yeah, I think that's the greatest part of the movie, is it's just a great introduction to this magical fantasy world that we've never seen before, never visited. It's always kind of like magic's been such a fascination with people for centuries and millennia. I mean, a lot of elements of mythology and like alchemy and Greek mythology are present in Harry Potter, the entire franchise and the characters.
Yeah, Nicholas Flamel is actually in other movies.
Yeah, like Nicholas Flamel is like an old literature character or person who really existed, but whether he actually practiced alchemy, that's kind of up in the air. But he's still associated with alchemy, which is really cool. And again,
but in terms of what you just said, J.K. Rowling used so many great classical literature ideas and themes and stories. And she kind of just made this boiling pot of all sorts of mythological, like, fairy tales, beasts, creatures, ideas. And I think that's why the movies are so its own thing.
Yeah, but real quick, there are actually a ton of references to past fiction. We won't get into all of them because there's so many, especially, like, the names. Like, Hermione is a reference to Hermes, the Greek god. But there are so many name references to past mythology and fiction. But some really quick ones that are interesting is, like, you could compare Harry and his story to Cinderella. You know, this young person who's kind of raised by angry, distant relatives who just don't treat them very well, and then he sort of becomes a prince in the Wizarding World, basically, you could say. The Mare of Erised is definitely a reference to Beauty and the Beast in the mirror in that film. Fluffy, the three-headed dog, is a reference to Cerberus, the three-headed dog that guards the underworld in Greek mythology. And then Sorcerer's Stone, again, we just said, is depicted in many stories and myths of alchemy.
And also you can compare the basilisk and chamber to the dragon in The Hobbit.
Yeah, but we're not on chamber yet.
Slow your horses.
Not yet.
And also, like, there are crazy names that are references to things, like Petunia, Aunt Petunia. Petunia is a flower that's defined by anger and jealousy. And so J.K., I think what made these stories so special was the amount of detail. Because, like, there are a couple of people that kind of said that they think they accused her of ripping them off. But, like, it's just like, you know, they just also had movies about, I mean, novels and stories about wizards. It's not like she created the idea of a wizard, you know what I mean? But the reasons why hers are so set apart from anything else is because of how dense they are, how much detail there is, how much information's in them, how much the myth goes back. Like, it is an entire world that is so well established in the first book and in the first film that nothing I've ever read can compare to it. And I mean, even at my age, my favorite thing to read is Harry Potter. And
oh, yeah, for sure.
I could put it down in a second. And I think that's why the first movie, it works so well, because it is a fish out of water story. Whereas the rest of the films, we're already there. We know what the world is. We know what the rules are. But what makes, I think, I know a lot of ways Sorcerer's Stone is my favorite, because we're discovering everything with Harry. And that's what makes it so special.
Yeah, exactly. And the first three books, they're actually not super long. Compared to the last four, which are very dense. But they are still dense with tons of characters, scenes, descriptions. Unfortunately, you can't make a 10-hour Harry Potter film, even though we'd all love to watch that.
Amazon will probably try.
So the producers and screenwriter Steve Kloves, they had to, you know, make tough decisions and adapt the book into a screenplay. And it's up to them to make those hard decisions of what to cut and what to change. And what to keep to make the story best for the medium of film.
Yeah, like there are definitely differences from the book to movie, but it's still as good as you can get for the movie. Because, like, there are things that, like, you didn't necessarily need. Like, at the end, there are actually more steps that the kids have to take to reach Voldemort and to reach Quirrell. Like, the poison test is something that I mean, they didn't need to put that in the
movie.
It would
have been cool.
It would have been cool to see, but like it would have been an extra 10 minutes or so, and they didn't really essentially need it. I think they did it perfectly where each obstacle was for each character.
Yeah, exactly.
You know what I mean? So Hermione did the weeds.
Ron, rather than Hermione doing everything.
Yeah, yeah, Ron did the chess set, although the chess seat is the only good thing Ron's ever done.
In Basilisk Fang.
Basilisk.
He just hangs out with Harry when they're in trouble all the time.
Yeah, exactly. And then Harry at the end. So each one of them had a part to play in those steps. So they didn't really need to do the poison scene. And,
yeah.
And also, like, I think obviously one of the biggest changes is definitely when they get detention. Neville's actually there at detention with them, not Ron.
Mm-hmm.
But it wouldn't have worked for the movie. So we need to have Ron there. So they obviously change things and put characters where they weren't in the books just to make it better for the movie.
Yeah, and so Steve Kloves, he does a great job. He did all the screenplays, and it makes me really hopeful for the next Fantastic Beasts movie because he's doing the screenplay with J.K. Rowling rather than her doing it by herself. She did the first two by herself, and I think that was one of the biggest weaknesses of those films. Not that the world isn't incredible, not that J.K.'s not an astounding writer with so many ideas, but writing books is so much different than screenwriting for film, and Kloves kind of needs to be with her in that writing room to determine the best decisions for the story for film. Before we continue, we have some breaking news from our friends at Manscaped who help keep this show possible. Use our coupon code RaidersOfTheLost at checkout from manscaped.com for 20% off and free shipping year-round. Manscaped has just released their Lawnmower 4.0 groomer, and let me tell you, this thing looks like a rocket ship out of the package. It's insane. It blows the 3.0 out of the water. Anthony and I are huge fans of Manscaped products ever since they became a sponsor of the show. I recommend getting one of their performance packages. They have a ton of different products as a bundle and sort of this one big box of goodies. You get the lawnmower groomer, you get the weed whacker, you get some body wipes, you get colognes, deodorizers. Manscaped.com is fantastic. Over 2 million men worldwide are currently trusting Manscaped.com with their products. Use our coupon code RaidersOfTheLost at checkout for 20% off and free shipping year-round.
Yeah, exactly, because he wrote all of the movies except for Order, and I would say Order is the weakest script out of all the films.
Possible, yeah.
And it's a daunting task. Imagine being Steve Kloves and walking into the first meeting with J.K. Rowling being like, I have to write your book into a movie. Like, that must be intimidating.
Mm-hmm.
But the way, and she didn't want to even meet him. She didn't even want, like, she thought the idea of someone else adapting her writing was just such a crazy thing to her. She didn't want it to happen, but it was kind of an inevitable thing. But what won her over was when they first met, Steve Kloves told her, he said, you know who my favorite character is? And she assumed that he was going to say Ron because he's like the comedic relief or something. But he said Hermione, and she instantly approved of him when he said that because Hermione is basically J.K. as herself in the book. So that J.K. herself relates to Hermione more than anyone. And so that's why it meant a lot to her that Kloves said that his favorite character was Hermione.
Yeah, and again, we're talking about film here, and you have this story that no one's ever really adapted anything like this into a film like this before. You know, we have wizards and this whole world and everything. So in this intense story and deep story of Harry Potter, this boy who's secretly a wizard, but he has no idea, and he's being raised by his hateful aunt and uncle and his cousin. And so what the screenwriter and producers do so well is within the first 15 minutes, you know, you don't have the patience and time of a book to tell these opening stories and all these situations with the Dursleys and Harry and getting into the Wizarding World, but they take 15 minutes. We learn pretty much everything we need to know about Harry, about his parents being dead. He's neglected and hated by his aunt, uncle, and cousin. Odd things happen to Harry whenever he's upset or feels angry. And his aunt and uncle are hiding something from him, but we never really know what it is. Harry never knows what it is. And then he finally learns he's a wizard from Hagrid when Hagrid shows up. And that all happens within 15 minutes of the film.
Oh, Hagrid shows up in 15?
Yeah.
Wow.
So that's line fast. When he tells him that he's a wizard, that's at the 15-minute mark about.
That's perfect, because you need to sell the audience as quickly as you can.
You got to get the magic going, yeah.
But they still, it seems like it's longer than that because it's such great filmmaking. I mean, you got so many iconic scenes. You got the letter scene. You get the Dumbledore McGonagall scene when Hagrid shows up, the zoo. Like, so much happens in that 15 minutes, like very major scenes. And the establishment of Harry's life is so important to the entire story, the rest of the films, because how we relate to Harry in those first 15 minutes is vital to the story succeeding, because we see how hard his life is, how little he has, how he lives in a world where there's no love for him. He has family, but they don't treat him like family. And he lives under a staircase. He has very little. He wears hand-me-down clothes. He barely eats anything. He's basically does all the chores for everyone in the house, and he lives a very sad, solitary existence, and he doesn't know anything more. And that makes us empathize with him so much because we feel for him, because you can tell just in that opening act, he's a good person. You know that if he had the opportunity, he would thrive. And so we want him to succeed. That's why we're along on the journey for him, because after that 15 minutes, we're like, we want him to do well.
Yeah, that's why he's so similar to Cinderella. And again, one of the most fascinating and memorable characters that fiction literature has brought us in the last century, for sure. And not only does the audience learn what kind of person Harry really is, because kind of what you just said, his normalcy in his life and what he thinks his life existence is just being like kind of like the house like caretaker to the Dursleys and being berated. In the book, it goes into more detail how he's bullied by Dursley and his friends, and he has no friends because Dudley doesn't let him have any friends, and so he's got a very sad existence. And then, just like Harry, the audience is learning what kind of person Harry is, what's deep down inside him as he enters the wizarding world, not just on the surface, but what kind of character traits he really has that he's been waiting to maybe show us or exude. And I mean, he becomes brave and loyal, ambitious and kind, and a powerful wizard, and all these situations that he gets himself into in his first year at Hogwarts, and obviously every film and story, it allows his personality to finally shine and grow.
And all of his important traits that help him out, along the rest of the films and books, they are able to sprout because of the values and moral compass that he develops from his humbling childhood. You know, I think Harry's greatest qualities are his ability to love, his modesty, his selflessness. His selflessness is probably his defining characteristic. And if he had been raised like Dudley had been raised, he would have been an evil, narcissistic, horrible person. And he would have failed as a wizard immediately, and he probably would have been corrupted by his power. But because of how he was raised, he is able to become the most selfless version of himself, and that selflessness allows him to make sacrifice after sacrifice to better the world.
And you can attribute Harry's childhood and the reason why he becomes such a selfless person to Albus Dumbledore. He's the one that places him at the Dursleys' house, because I think Dumbledore is such a wise person, because he realizes that if Harry grows up in the wizarding world where he's the most famous wizard in the world, everyone knows his name, he'll probably be spoiled with privilege and everyone will want to be his friend, and he'll grow up to be just like Dudley in a way. And
worse, maybe.
Probably even worse. Yeah. I mean, he'll probably be consumed with power, whereas you put him in a very powerless situation. Obviously, Dumbledore asks the Dursleys to treat him like one of their own, but they don't.
He knew they wouldn't.
But he asked them still. Yeah. In the letter, he does ask them to treat them as their own son. To an extent, they give him a roof over his head and clothes and food, so it's not like they were the worst parents alive. There are definitely worse parents out there to have. But Dumbledore was so clever in keeping him there. And also, we eventually learned that having him stay at the Dursley's house is the ultimate form of protection for Harry later on in his life from Voldemort.
Yeah, and on top of that, you could say that the household he grew up in was such a bad environment for him because it was born of spite. Because Petunia spited her sister for her not being magical. And she hated that she was just a normal muggle. And that fed into her hatred for Harry and her despise for the boy. And the inability to be like her sister and be the special one in the family is what drove her to treat Harry so poorly. And obviously, Dursley and Dudley, like, they followed her lead. You know what I mean? If she had been a kind person, I'm sure Vernon and Dudley would have been kinder people, but because she was driven by that jealousy she harbored, that's why Harry grew up in that environment.
Well, that, and also Petunia wouldn't have married to someone like Vernon if she was a good person, because Vernon himself, yes, that's Petunia's, the source of her spite. We learn Half-Blood Prince because of the extreme envy she has of her sister Lily, Harry's mother. But Vernon, he just on his own hates Harry Potter because he's different. They talk about that a lot in the book, how he doesn't like different people and all these weird people in these cloaks walking around because they're celebrating something. And then when he learns that Harry is just like one of those different freaks that they call them, that's why he doesn't like him as well.
Yeah, there's a lot of great metaphors for discrimination and racism in this story, especially not just with Vernon, but in terms of how pure blood race wizards view any Muggleborns
or Muggles in general. So it goes both ways, really.
Yeah, I mean, just the Malfoys are so discriminatory towards anyone who's not a pure blood wizard, and we'll get into later in the later films how that it becomes more of an extreme conflict for the entire wizarding community, and especially in terms of the Dark Lord. I mean, his goal is to make a race of pure blood wizards, and so there's a lot of incredibly rich and dense metaphors for discrimination and racism in these books.
Yeah, and then we have poor Dudley Dursley, who, honestly, every time I watch him, like when I was younger, I'd be like, this kid's the most evil brat of all time. But then you watch him, I feel nothing but pity for this poor child, because the Dursleys, Petunia and Vernon, hated Harry so much, they decided to put extra care and love and spoiled Dudley more than any kid should ever be spoiled in their entire lives.
Kind of like just showing off to Harry.
Yeah, and so basically they end up ruining Dudley's life, because there's no way Dudley in the far future will be a functioning human being or an adult in the real world because of what they've done to him this way.
Yeah, like think about when he says goodbye in the last film, in the second to last film, he seems like he's so like out of it, you know what I mean, and socially awkward.
And but the books go into so much more detail about how he's such a bad person, he's such a big bully, and then the incredible like weight gain that he has because they keep stuffing him with cakes, and then they're all forced to go on that grapefruit diet in the book, but Harry's secretly eating the magical cakes upstairs in his room. But Dudley gets a piece of work because of what his parents do to him, and it's not his fault. Yeah. You know, if they raised him, like you said, like good people, then you could see that Dudley and Harry could have been best buds at some point.
47! Last year I had 48!
38.
38.
Come on, kid. But exactly, what kid gets 38 presents? They do it because they hate Harry so much.
Yeah, exactly. One of the most defining aspects of the entire franchise, not the books, but the franchise, is the music. And what John Williams did in the first three films is so special, and it's on the par with what he did with Star Wars. I think they're just at the same level with iconography and the memorable nature of the notes and the themes. And I think the Harry Potter theme, especially Hedwig's theme, is such an iconic piece of music. You could argue it is the most iconic piece of music ever made. That argument for sure could be made.
Star Wars fans are typing so hard right now.
Oh my God, yeah.
Get over it, guys.
I can hear them. But what he did was just so monumental. I mean, imagine, remember the first time you saw that trailer and you heard that theme?
Yeah.
And it's like, and the only way to describe it is magical, because somehow John Williams, as iconic as a composer he's always been,
and already was established as the greatest of all time,
he still managed to make a piece of music that was so perfect for the movie that you can't compare it to anything else.
It's such a shame that he didn't do any of the rest after Prisoner of Azkaban. But I love how Prisoner of Azkaban, just like how Cuarón changed the tone of the films and the aesthetics, he changed the music as well, too. And and he kept the themes a little bit, but he went a more modern approach, which is what Alfonso Cuarón, and like tons of jazz elements.
I do wish that the other composers, Patrick Doyle and Nicholas Hooper, used a little bit more of J-Dub's themes.
I agree.
Because 4, 5, and 6, great scores, but they were just missing that quality that he brought to it. And then Alexandre Desplat capped it off really well with the Deathly Hallows Part 1 and 2. And he used a lot of what John Williams created and built on those. But I just think 4, 5, and 6, they didn't feel the same. But it's hard to follow up John Williams.
Yeah, and if you're a fan of John Williams' work and you know his scores like by heart, kind of like we do, there's so many elements in the Harry Potter score that resemble Jaws and E.T. Extraterrestrial, Home Alone, and so it's so fun to listen to the score and try to pick up on John Williams' signatures that are all over his movies, because every artist has kind of like their main go-tos.
It's their voice.
And their artistic voices, and his is all over the place, and you can hear the elements, like you can hear their Jaws theme kind of in some parts of the movie.
You can hear Star Wars.
Yeah, you can hear it all over. It's so fun to listen to.
And it's the same thing as a band. All their albums sound the same because that's their voice.
But again, adding to the medieval aesthetic with all the brass, the horns, the trumpets, that medieval quality, it's so fun and magical.
Yeah, and whatever that little piano instrument it is.
Harpsichord, I believe.
That he used for the main theme.
It was the first piano ever made. It's a string piano.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
And he used
that's why it has a like string sound, like a plucking sound.
I think the first time he used it was in Home Alone.
Yeah.
And originally James Horner was going to do the music, but he had to back out for scheduling. So thank God. I love James Horner, but I'm thankful that John Williams is the one who went in it, because he actually worked with Columbus on three movies before this.
Yeah, and I'm telling you, you could swap Home Alone and Harry Potter in their music, and they kind of could fit in each other's movies. It's kind of great, because Home Alone is an underrated score big time.
It's a great score.
People only listen to it around like the Christmas time and only watch that movie, but that score is fantastic.
100%.
It's also very magical.
And on top of that, obviously the production design of this movie is unbelievable, and they established the world so well, because this was early 2000s, 2001. The CGI in this movie is kind of questionable at times. It's not perfect, and so it wasn't quite up to par with what it, even close to it is now. And so everything was built in terms of sets. And the production designer, the first time we saw Diagon Alley, it was just jaw-dropping. It was really there. I loved watching behind-the-scenes footage and videos of them actually touring the sets. And I mean, we've been to the Harry Potter world a few times, and it's just so tangible, and that attention to detail, like on set, like every drawer had like something in it that was just there. Like even if it wasn't on camera, the production team actually still managed, they made it and put it into the sets. And I think that the J.K. Rowling, she had to approve of all of the sets before they filmed. J.K. Rowling actually owns the rights completely, flat out, to Harry Potter. And so she has final say over everything.
Wicked smart, JK.
So they have to go to her for the theme parks. They have to go to her for the movies. Any kind of things they're trying to sell, she has to approve it all.
Yeah, not only are the sets very detailed, but they're enormous. I mean, Hogwarts Castle, they built an actual large miniature to scale. And that's the when you see shots of the castle. Mm-hmm. That's why it looks real, because it is.
Yeah.
And then, I mean, the classrooms are great. The castle itself, the interiors, the moving staircases, the Great Hall, you know, that's a real set that they've built. And
so they actually filmed at a few castles in the UK for the exteriors. And I think Oxford College for the one of the campus yards is the grounds is there. But otherwise, they built all the interior sets.
Yeah, and plus, let's give a shout-out to all the props and wardrobe teams, because they are the unsung heroes as well. And unfortunately, this film lost production design and costume to Moulin Rouge. Which, yeah, I guess, but
man.
I mean, like,
the
come
Oscars
on.
Love musicals.
Come on, man. This was incredible. It was on a different level.
How did this not win production design?
Oh, well. Alora. And real quick, back on Chris Columbus, why did he only make two movies? Why did he just do Sorcerers and Chambers? Why didn't he do any more? These films take years to make. And yes, I know that they come out basically year after year, but pre-production on these start years in advance. I mean, just because they were filming Sorcerer's Stone doesn't mean they weren't on pre-production on Chamber of Secrets and etc. So I'm sure every day of this guy's life for 12 hours a day for 5 years, he was working on these movies. You know, he's got a family. So I think two movies is like the max that someone like him could do.
Before we continue, I have to tell you all about movieposters.com, the number one place to get your posters online today. Use our very special promo code Raiders15. Again, Raiders15 to get 15% off your order today at movieposters.com. If you're a fan of movies, if you're a fan of films, if you're a fan of television shows, there's no better way to express that love than with a movie poster to deck out your house. Head on over to the website, movieposters.com, and use our special promo, Raiders15, again, Raiders15, to get 15% off your order today. But also, it's not just that, but they had to film them as fast as they could, because the kids were aging up. So they couldn't wait long before filming. Like, otherwise, you know, Daniel Radcliffe would be 25 playing a 16-year-old.
That's what I mean. The workload is doubled. It's like doing two movies at the same time.
Yeah, so what Warner Brothers did was they would go into pre-production while another movie was filming. So while they were making Chamber, Azkaban was in pre-production. While they were making Azkaban, like James Newell, the director of Goblet, he went to tour the set at Azkaban, and like Quaron showed him the footage he shot, because like it takes so long, just like you said, to do the pre-production. There's no way they could do it back to back. They have to do it kind of simultaneously. There's like never an end. And they even leaves in studios in London, which is the studio they rented out. They just rented it for 15 years. They never stopped shooting there, ever.
Yeah, it takes years to make a movie, everybody, especially big ones like this. I mean, just scouting locations and building sets and designing wardrobe, everything takes a very long time. It's not like, oh, it's 6 months, we make a Harry Potter movie. Years and years. How about we take a break and go into our intermission, where we'll play some fun movie games. And this intermission is brought to you by our friends at manscaped.com. Use our coupon code RaidersOfTheLost at checkout for 20% off and free shipping.
Let's go.
All right, let's do our movie challenges and trivia. The first one we're going to do is our movie quote competition. I actually have a couple that some fans sent us in.
Ooh, let's hear.
And I actually have a couple from some fans of ours. The first one I immediately knew, but it might be a tricky one for you. So let me say it, because it's a film that I've seen like 12 times. I don't know how many times you've seen it. All right, this is from Poppy. He punched the highlights out of her hair.
Scott Pilgrim.
Yeah, there you go. Yeah. And then from Anthony Buccino. This one I don't know. I didn't look it up. He just sent it to me. If I like a moment, for me personally, I don't like to have the distraction of the camera. I just want to stay in it.
That's a movie quote? Yes. Say it again.
If I like a moment, for me personally, I don't like to have the distraction of the camera. I just want to stay in it.
It's, I mean, it's obviously an act. They're playing an actor. I don't know it. I don't think I know it. Oh, it's got it. So I just Googled it. The Secret Life of Walter Mitty.
Oh,
good one, bud.
The photography.
Good one.
Yeah,
Sean Penn.
Yeah.
Yeah. Sean Penn, and he's like, won't take the photo of like the animal.
It's even in the trailer, too.
Yeah.
All right, now you do a movie quote. I use theirs for mine.
Okay, here's my movie quote. Just a fly in the ointment, the monkey in the wrench, the pain in the ass.
Tropic Thunder.
No. So actually, I'll start. The first character asks, who are you? And then this character says, just a fly in the ointment, the monkey in the wrench, the pain in the ass.
Cape Fear?
Here's a hint. I'm a little more partial to Roy Rogers.
Oh, it's a Die Hard.
Yeah.
That was good. That was tough.
Yeah.
All right. Let's do guess this movie release year. Mrs. Doubtfire.
That's a good one. I'm going to go with 1996.
1993.
Oh, I was way off.
Super close.
Yeah.
Actually, yeah, you're way off.
I was super close.
You were way off.
I was very close. All right, I did a John Hurt movie because he's in
Ollivander.
Yeah, Ollivander. Okay, The Elephant Man, directed by David Lynch.
98.
No, 1980.
No, I was way off.
Yeah, that was way off. That was David Lynch's like first big movie direction.
That was pretty bad. That was my worst answer yet. All right, let's do our movie pop quiz now. When George Lucas pitched the idea of Indiana Jones to Steven Spielberg while on vacation in Hawaii, what was the original name of the character?
I don't know. I can't remember.
Indiana Smith.
Indiana Smith.
They thought it sounded too generic.
That does sound very generic. Okay, I did another Harry Potter actor one. Robbie Coltrane, who plays Hagrid. Which Bond movie is he in with Pierce Brosnan?
GoldenEye?
Not Tomorrow Never Dies.
Ah. And now it's time for Biggest Hater of the Week, and this one is from a TikTok clip where we posted of Saving Private Ryan. And in the clip, Anthony's talking about how Corporal Upham represents basically the entire world, how in Europe and in the Western world, where everyone basically ignored Germany during their rise to power, and that Germany was building their army which they weren't supposed to. They're breaking their pacts and treaties, which said that they couldn't build their armies, their navies, their tanks. So they were secretly doing all this, but all these countries knew what was going on, but they refused to act and didn't act, and that's what helped lead to the rise of Germany in Europe.
What's his username?
And then in the comments, Sandy MDC said, well, if you paid attention in history class, you would understand why we didn't get involved until later in the war. He also said information instead of until. But I mean, if you actually paid attention to the clip, we're not talking about why America was late to the party. We're talking about why the world let it happen.
We were talking about Western Europe is what I said.
The allies. So yeah, they let Germany rise to power.
And I was talking about before there was even a war.
Yeah, so we weren't talking about it.
Yeah.
And then someone else
listen to the words I say.
Anyways, I also want to introduce a new topic for our intermission and biggest fan of the week. And so our very first fan of the week is going to be Jordan Codner. Jordan was our very first patron. He still is to this day. So thank you, Jordan, so much for all the support now and the future.
You're the best, Jordan.
And on this day in film history, Finding Dory and Big Daddy were released.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
And streaming recommendation for this week is going to be a film we watched over the weekend. It's called Dances with Wolves.
Oh, my God.
God. With Kevin Costner. He wrote, directed, and starred in this movie. And I had seen it years ago, and I knew it was a good movie, but it absolutely blew me away. It's an unbelievable film. He did such a fantastic job directing it. It's just a legitimate, bona fide epic. And it's got some of the greatest action sequences I've ever seen. It's got this incredible sequence of a Native American tribe, the Sioux tribe, hunting buffalo. And it's a groundbreaking film. Kevin Costner was so empathetic towards the Native Americans, and he told such a beautiful story about their culture and the idea of accepting other cultures and other races. And he actually became an honorary member of the tribe after the film came out because they respected what he did in the film so much. And so I think if anyone is interested in any kind of like period pieces in Native American culture, check out Dances with Wolves. It's free on Netflix. Let's get back to Harry Potter and the Sorcerer's Stone, everyone. And I want to bring up the next greatest triumph of these films, especially this film, has got to be the casting, because all these characters are iconic in their own right and so memorable. And somehow this production managed to cast every single role perfectly, I believe. I think every single actor and actress is perfectly suited to their roles. It's unbelievable what they pulled off.
I mean, yeah, we got Richard Harris as Dumbledore, Maggie Smith, Robbie Coltrane, Dan Radcliffe's awesome as Harry, then Emma Watson, Rupert Grint, John Hurt, we just talked about, Warwick Davis plays many roles in the Harry Potter world, Fiona Shaw's Aunt Petunia is fantastic, and Richard Griffiths played Vernon Dursley, he's great. So this entire film, all movies, they seem to be perfectly cast, like you said, and I could never, ever in my life imagine anyone else playing any of these characters besides the actors who do them, especially Alan Rickman as Severus Snape.
I think Alan Rickman is perfect. I also think that Ralph Fiennes is absolutely pitch perfect as Voldemort. And in terms of Harry, I think it was obviously a very difficult thing to cast the lead of this franchise, especially because when you're casting this franchise, like, the studio's like, we want to make 7 movies out of this. There's a lot riding on this. We have a huge investment, and we expect to make a few billion dollars on this franchise. And so you have to put that on the shoulders of an 11-year-old kid, which is very daunting for that little kid. And it's a lot of responsibility because, yeah, there are plenty of characters in this movie, but it's called Harry Potter and the Sorcerer's Stone. You know what I mean? He is the lead. Harry's in nearly every single scene. He's involved in all of the scenes that take place except for maybe one or two. And so it's vital that they cast it right. And Daniel Radcliffe, I think, was perfectly cast, even though he doesn't physically fit the
description of Harry.
Description of Harry. He's not tall.
He's supposed to be taller than Ron and green eyes.
Yeah, but he still, I think, he captured the essence and the heart and the vulnerability and the personality of Harry perfectly. And it was a difficult process to cast him. They went through 5,000 auditions, but because J.K. Rowling was adamant that it had to be a British actor. She only wanted UK actors for all of these roles.
Yeah, so British, Irish, Welsh, Scottish.
Yeah, so she especially was adamant about trying to get as many Brits as possible. And so they tried casting so many kids. And what happened was Daniel Radcliffe, he was in a TV movie called David Copperfield. And it was his first movie role. And he's maybe like 2 years younger than in Sorcerer's Stone.
1999,
And he was it was a pretty big hit in England, but his parents wanted him to focus on school. Now, Chris Columbus had seen that movie and adored his performance. And so when Chris Columbus was actually pitching the movie, he was showing the producers Daniel Radcliffe in Copperfield as an example of what he would want Harry to be like. And so he was always imagining Daniel Radcliffe as this role. And he tried talking to the parents, but Radcliffe's parents were like, no, he's going to focus on school. We don't want him to be a movie star. We want him to get an education before anything. And so they rejected him, and so then they started the casting audition process for months. And then out of the blue, a random freak occurrence happened where Chris Columbus and David Heyman, the producer of the movie, went to the theater to see a play, and Radcliffe and his parents were there as well, and they were sitting a couple of rows ahead of them. And Heyman and Columbus just kept staring at Daniel Radcliffe, thinking like, oh my God, this is it. It has to be him. And so after the play was over, they spoke to the parents, and they finally convinced them to let Daniel Radcliffe audition and screen test, and once they did, he got the role. and so impressive for such, just a kid. Obviously, his acting is not perfect in Sorcerer's Stone. In every film, Radcliffe gets better. All the actors get better.
He became a very, very good actor.
I think because by Deathly Hallows, like that scene when he walks into the forest ready to die and sacrifice himself, it's the best acting I've seen Radcliffe do.
Nice, phenomenal actor.
And now he's become a great, great actor. But the three kids, they were so, because they're kids and they're inexperienced, and they're on a big movie set. They were messing up so bad and their acting was so poor that the crew had to set up three cameras at all times to just keep recording because they couldn't afford using just one camera because they were messing up so much.
Yeah, and he did an amazing job. And I mean, Emma Watson of the trio is the best in this movie. She kind of carries the acting for the three of them and whenever they're in the scenes together.
I agree.
Rupert's great as the comedic relief. But yeah, Daniel Radcliffe transformatively is the best actor by the end of this franchise in the story.
And even though Emma is probably has a better, more successful career. I mean, she was Belle in the $1 billion movie, and they're going to make, a franchise out of that. I think Radcliffe is making very interesting choices with his acting roles.
Yeah, he doesn't need money, and I think with him, he wanted to get away from the massive film productions. When you live half your life on a giant movie studio set, you probably want to, do smaller films and something more artistic.
Yeah.
And then, let's get to the characters. So the first magical character we meet, besides Harry, is Hagrid. And besides Vernon, to an extent, Hagrid becomes like this first father figure in Harry's life and ends up, in my opinion, being more of like an uncle figure to him towards the rest of the story. But Hagrid is the one who Dumbledore trusts to introduce Harry not only just into the wizarding world, but to tell Harry he's a wizard. And this is like that secret or that thing that the Dursleys have been keeping from him that Harry's always wanted to know. And he has a huge role in Sorcerer's Stone and Chamber of Secrets as well. Unfortunately, in the films, Hagrid kind of just tapers out for the rest of the movies. He doesn't have too much to do. But he's an integral figure in Harry's life in the wizarding world and in Sorcerer's Stone.
Hagrid is one of the strengths of this movie and why it works so well. And it's an amazing feat that how they filmed it because, I mean, Robbie Coltrane, I think, is like 6 feet tall, but Hagrid in the books is 12 feet tall. But in the movie, they made him like 8 foot 10 or something. So he's like nearly 9 foot tall. And what they did was they used a body double for any wide shots or shots that are, shots that are filmed from far away. And then like all the close-ups are obviously Robbie Coltrane. But for the body double, they put an animatronic head on top of him that was in the shape of Robbie Coltrane's face. So it looked like the actor Robbie Coltrane, but it's just like a robotic head on the body double.
Yeah, and these are the wide shots, whereas the close-up shots where he's with the characters, they even just do like depth of field perception and camera tricks to make him seem a little bigger, but the wide shots is always a body double.
And I think Hagrid, he had to be the first person to bring him into this world because Hagrid is so lovable. He's so kind, pure of heart, and he's very trustworthy. And I think that once you when you meet him, you can instantly feel at ease.
Yeah, he's the one who brought Harry as a baby to Privet Drive, so he's always been around waiting for him to come back into his life in a way. And Hagrid is very similar to Harry because Hagrid's half giant, so his entire life, even though he's part wizard and he's been in the wizarding community, like you talked about earlier in the episode, there are a lot of themes of racism and discrimination in the wizarding world, and Hagrid has gone through that his entire life because he's half giant. So he's lived a tough life socially, just like Harry has in his world.
Robin Williams apparently was a huge fan of the books, and he offered to play Hagrid for free without pay because he wanted to do it so badly. But Robbie Coltrane, the actor, was actually J.K.'s first choice for any role. He was the first person cast, and he was the only pick she wanted for Hagrid.
And again, they only wanted British actors, really. So that's the main reason why he was turned down. And Hagrid's tasked with bringing him into the wizarding world, which is so fun. You know, the first time we go to Diagon Alley, and Hagrid's also the person, the wizard, who tells Harry how his parents really died, how Voldemort killed his parents, and that it wasn't a car crash. And so Hagrid is really instrumental in the foundation of Harry Potter and the wizarding world.
And this movie's so important for the franchise because Harry in this movie is the surrogate of the audience. He's us because it's all new to him. It's all new to us. So we're discovering everything as he's discovering everything. I think the discovery of the world is the best part about this movie and what makes it, I think, very special compared to most of the other films.
And then Harry's first wizarding friend is Ron Weasley. Ron's loyal. He's funny. Comes from nothing just like Harry, despite being a pureblood wizard. And so that's why they're so similar. And honestly, the Weasleys are just like our family. Just a bunch of boys. We don't have a sister, but just like a bunch of dudes always in trouble coming from nothing. So
wearing hand-me-downs. And we always relate to the Weasleys.
Yeah, and Rupert and Ron provide that great comedic relief. And he does have a lot to do in this film in terms of like plot and saving the day. But after this, he's kind of just along for the ride.
Poor guy. He's hoping Hermione notices him.
And then Hermione Granger is his second wizarding friend, which really they aren't friends yet. Not until the troll scene. And Hermione's a muggle born and mudblood. And so you can see that J.K. Rowling surrounded Harry with a lot of characters who are similar to him in a way of where they're
outcasts.
Outcasts, exactly. Or they face discrimination in different ways, with Ron being poor, Hagrid being half giant, Hermione being a muggle born and mudblood. So, but that doesn't stop her from being the most clever witch of her age.
And that's why it's so important. These first relationships and these first meetings, they're vital to Harry. And they also reflect who he has become from his childhood. Because if he, like we said earlier, had been raised like Dudley, he would have looked down upon Ron. He would have looked down on Hermione. And he would have gravitated towards someone like Malfoy, who he meets at the castle. And because of who he is, Harry immediately identifies Malfoy as a villain and as a bad person. But if he had been like Dudley, he probably would have wanted to become friends with him. And so that's a vital point in Harry's life, making that decision to reject Malfoy and stick with Ron.
Yeah, Draco's his arch nemesis besides Voldemort. And in the books, actually, Harry meets Draco when he's at Diagon Alley trying on cloaks and getting sized up and everything. So that's where he actually meets Draco. But he meets him in the movie before at the Great Hall before the kids go in to get sorted. And Draco,
first of all, I love when at Diagon Alley, Hagrid just bails.
Yeah.
He just disappears. He's like, he'll be fine.
No, it's before Diagon Alley.
Yeah.
When he's on platform 9 3/4, he's like, where the hell do I go, Hagrid?
What if he never got on the train? He's just like sitting around Waterloo Station, whichever British train station that is.
King's Cross.
Yeah.
But Draco is an interesting character because Draco is pure blood, very wealthy, powerful family, and he's interested in powerful and connected wizards. So why not, or who better to make friends with than Harry Potter? When you find out he's on the train, you find out he's going to the school at the same time as you. And that's why Draco, when he first meets Harry, he's trying to be his friend. He wants him to join, and they can work together to do all sorts of weird, creepy, pure blood stuff.
They could be goth kids together.
But it's interesting because in the books, again, he meets him earlier on, before Hermione and Ron.
It's the sign of the defining characteristic of Harry, of always trying to choose the right thing to do. And choosing Ron as his friend is the right thing. One of my favorite parts of the entire film has got to be the reveal of Hogwarts Castle. The music's playing, and the kids are on all the boats with the lanterns, and they're on the water, and then they finally see it for the first time, and the castle is just on the cliff, and the warm lights are glowing from within all the lights, and it's an unbelievable moment of the movie. It's transcendent in a lot of ways, and it's kind of like a discovery of, like, you're literally entering a new world, and you're there with Harry, and you're so excited because he has no idea what to expect. Most of the other kids, they know what to expect. Either they've heard all about Hogwarts, or they have siblings who have been to Hogwarts. But Harry, he has no idea what's going to happen. I think that's what's so much fun about that moment.
Yeah, and then I love getting to the castle and the sorting, and we like get in touch with Professor McGonagall, who becomes kind of like an aunt-like figure to Harry, and she gets him the Nimbus 2000 for his Quidditch match, which is a great scene, getting his first broomstick. We meet
That's kind of like a college student getting paid by Nike.
Yeah. we are introduced to Snape, who immediately has it out for Harry. We learn that potions class, that he just hates him and embarrasses him in front of everybody. And of course, we're introduced to Albus Dumbledore.
And in terms of Snape, real quick, so Alan Rickman, he was told in secret by J.K. Rowling certain things about Snape that no one else had known yet, because she hadn't revealed them in the books yet. And no one really knows for sure what exactly she told him, but I believe the gist of it was nothing super revealing, not the big twist at the end.
If you've never seen the end, don't listen to what he's about to say.
I'm not going
to
spoil it, but in terms of the fact that there's a reason why Snape despises Harry and why he doesn't like him. And there's actually a very emotional, important reason behind it. And so I think that's what she told Alan Rickman to help him with his performance. Because otherwise, it wouldn't really make sense. Like, why does he just hate Harry? Because he's famous and because he killed Voldemort. I mean, it's a little, it's so much more complex than that, which is why Snape is such a strong character.
Yeah, and I can't wait to talk about it more in the later books and movies where he gets, we learn so much more about him. He's a bigger part of the story. But then Albus Dumbledore, obviously Harry's most important father figure throughout his life, though he doesn't know it yet in Sorcerer's Stone. And Dumbledore, when you learn later on the background of why Dumbledore does the things he does and how much he cares about Harry, and you watch the earlier films, you kind of see, like, you know, you understand the things that J.K. was, the dialogue he was saying and the actions for Dumbledore, but he's kind of just like a passerby observer of Harry Potter for the first couple stories.
I think that he's curious to see exactly what kind of person Harry has grown into.
And again, that decision of leaving him with the Dursleys helped protect Harry.
Yeah, exactly, because he understands that he has, in so many ways, set up Harry on a quest that he's unaware of yet, but Dumbledore is basically lining up, and these are the early moments of that. And so I think Dumbledore just wants to make sure that Harry has become the person that he had the potential to become, because if Harry if Harry isn't as good of a person as he is, then there's going to be no hope for them in the end.
One of my favorite parts of this movie, because I think they do the most of it in Sorcerer's Stone, is the magical classes. And so the books are full of great detail, all of them, of Harry and the students going to classes. And this movie particularly has the potions class with Snape, where we learn of Snape's supposed hatred of Harry immediately.
Mr. Potter.
Harry's first flight at the Quidditch Quidditch class with Madame Hooch, which is super fun, and that's where McGonagall sees him catch the ball, the remember all, so that he, you know, becomes Seeker of the Quidditch team.
Only I can't remember what I've forgotten.
Oh, the thing with that, Neville, when he gets the remember all from his grandmother, and it goes off and he can't remember what it is, what Neville forgot was his cloak, so he's the only one at the table not wearing his cloak. He's just wearing a sweater.
That's funny.
And then also the charms class is super fun because, you know, we get to see some spells and some magic, Wingardium Leviosa. But also the charms class scene is really important because, again, Hermione, Ron, and Harry aren't really friends yet. They're, you know, in the same class, so they go all the places together. They're friendly, but still Hermione is kind of made fun of by Ron and the other boys in Gryffindor, and so she doesn't have a ton of friends yet. And the charms class is what kind of really... After the class and Ron's making fun of her, that makes her cry and go into the dungeons to cry in the girls' bathroom, and then that's what leads to them having to save her from the troll. And after they save her from the troll, that's when this trio finally becomes great friends, because Harry and Ron recognize that their actions caused Hermione to put herself accidentally in great danger.
Yeah, and then Harry and Ron they sacrifice themselves to try and save her, and then even more so, Hermione lied to the teachers, saying that she went after the troll thinking she could take it on, basically saving them from being punished. So she earned their respect and they earned her respect.
And then they're just, to quote Forrest Gump, peas and carrots after that.
Probably the least memorable actor in the entire franchise is Ian Holm as Professor Quirrell, because he's just a one-off villain. But I think he did a solid job. And Quirrell is such an interesting character, more so in the books, because he's someone who has secretly been devoted to the Dark Lord and spent the past few years seeking him out, trying to find the Dark Lord. And all the Death Eaters, we learn, like, they got signs and whispers and they knew he was there, but they all were, I think, too afraid to act on it. Whereas Quirrell, you can say, is the only person who ever had the courage to seek out the Dark Lord and try to find him.
Yeah, what's great is J.K.'s main villain throughout the Harry Potter franchise isn't really at his strength in this movie. I think that's one of the strengths of this movie, is the introduction to the Wizarding World. Voldemort is at his weakest that we see him in the films and stories. So the stakes are kind of a little bit lower in terms of danger surrounding Harry Potter in a way, even though he's at Hogwarts where kids are constantly put in crazy danger, like flying on broomsticks 100 feet in the air.
Yeah, exactly. But on top of that, we don't even know Voldemort's the villain.
Yeah.
Whereas all the other movies, yeah, Voldemort is the big bad. So the stakes, like you said, their stakes are super high. But at this moment, we're like, the big conflict is trying to stop who we think is Snape from getting the stone.
Yeah, so they think that Snape is the villain, and they actually figure out that because of the clues accidentally let out by Hagrid, that Nicholas Flamel, his Sorcerer's Stone, is being guarded under Hogwarts, underneath Fluffy, under that trap door that they accidentally stumble upon. And so it's great to, like, watch them do some investigating and go into the restricted section and try to figure out Nicholas Flamel's past, the Sorcerer's Stone, why Snape's trying to steal it, and how to stop him.
And the way J.K. wrote Snape was so brilliant because every movie, it's just like, is he good or is he bad? You never know truly what side is Snape on until the end of the series. And this is an example of, like, he's clearly trying to help, we find out, but so many instances and examples make it seem like he is absolutely the villain of the movie, and we are endlessly suspicious of it because of how Snape acts towards Harry, and that adds to the suspicion that Harry has of him. And so it's just a brilliant way of portraying this complex character who we never know what side is he on.
And again, all these conflicts and situations that Harry gets himself into, whether he does it on purpose or not or by accident, they really show his true character in such great ways. And this entire story, every movie, every book, Harry's just faced with so many challenges that he has to overcome. So I made like a list from this movie of his challenges. I'm sure I'm missing a few, but it starts off with surviving the torments and poor treatment of the Dursleys for 11 years, learning and facing the truth about his parents' death, entering the wizarding world, which he knows nothing about, despite the fact that he's a living legend, basically, and every witch and wizard knows his name, making friends like any normal kid going to school, learning magic, his first Quidditch match, saving Hermione from the troll with Ron, helping solve the mystery of Nicholas Flamel, resisting the temptation of returning to the Mirror of Erised, helping Hagrid keep Norbert a secret. In the book, they actually have like this crazy elaborate plan to help Norbert escape, and they use the invisibility yeah. cloak, and Ron's brother's friends come to take him away from like the top of the castle. It's actually really cool. Solving the mystery again of what Fluffy is guarding the Sorcerer's Stone, stopping who he thinks is Snape from obtaining the stone, and then stopping Voldemort, who is working through Quirrell to obtain the Sorcerer's Stone. So a ton of challenges for an 11-year-old kid.
That's why the story works so well, because conflict drives story, conflict drives plot. And that's, what is that, 15 conflicts just for one character?
Yeah.
It's unbelievable. That's why the story is just constantly propelling, never slows down, has an amazing pace, and just keeps you enthralled from start to finish.
Yeah, one of my favorite concepts of the film is the Mirror of Erised. So Harry discovers the Mirror of Erised after Christmas morning when he gets presents for the first time in his life, and he gets the invisibility cloak.
I've got presents.
He gets his father's, yeah, loads of them. He's got the invisibility cloak from his father, who he doesn't know who sent it, but he has that, there's that flowy handwriting, obviously, it's Dumbledore. Mm. And so they're trying it out, and he goes and he discovers the Mirror of Erised in Hogwarts Castle. And he spends a couple nights just staring into the Mirror of Erised because he sees his parents for the first time in his entire life. And what he doesn't understand is that the Mirror of Erised shows the deepest and most desperate desires of any human being that looks into it. It does not show the truth. And Dumbledore sneaks up on him and explains to him that men have wasted... He's just watching him invisible. It's kind of creepy, Dumps. He tells him that men have wasted away looking at it.
Men have wasted away.
And it's interesting. The inscription around the Mirror of Erised reads, Erised stra eru oit ube... I'm like, oh my God. Hold on. And it's really interesting. There's a backwards. Let me say that. Sorry. There's an inscription on the Mirror of Erised that's in reverse, and the inscription reads backwards as, I show not your face, but your heart's desire.
And the mirror is a vital part of the movie, of the story. At first, it seems like it's just a random scene. That's just another great detail that J.K. put into the story, but it becomes vital because the mirror is how Harry manages to find the stone. When he looks in the mirror and he sees that the stone is in his pocket, and only he's able to see it and not Quirrell, because Dumbledore, using one of his finer ideas, made it so that the only person who could find the stone was someone who wanted it, but not to use it for themselves.
Exactly. So the Mirror of Erised, Dumbledore explains to him it's going to be moved. He doesn't tell him it's going to be moved below the castle. Yeah. And that's basically Dumbledore's obstacle at the end of the underground, whatever you want to call it, like obstacle course of getting the Sorcerer's Stone. And this obstacle course is super fun because we have the
obstacle course.
Yeah, I don't know what else to call it.
It's like, what's that kids' games we were talking about?
Legend of the Hidden Temple.
No, the other one.
Oh,
the sporty one.
Guts.
A
Nickelodeon. If you're American, it's like a fun kids from the 90s obstacle course game. But yeah, there's this magical obstacle course to get to the stone that obviously Hagrid's obstacles, Fluffy on the top of the trapdoor, and then we have the Devil's Snare, which the Herbology professor, Professor Sprout, put there. And then we have the Flying Keys, which you can assume Madam Hooch put for Harry. Harry uses the broom to catch the correct key. In the book, we have Professor Snape's Potion Riddle, which would have been really cool to watch. But again, like you said, it's better that each character just has one obstacle because Hermione is the one that solves most of them besides them. In the books, yeah. Ron has the chess game, which he has to win. He ends up sacrificing himself so that Harry can keep going forwards.
And me, I'll be the knight.
It's the only way. And then we have the Mirror of Erised that Harry's the only one that can defeat because he has experience with it and he understood Dumbledore's wisdom when he told him about it.
And this is a great moment leading to us understanding Voldemort in the later films because we don't understand why Voldemort is still alive. And it's basically his soul has latched on to Quirrell. And then when Harry destroys Quirrell, then the soul is released, and that's what, like, dives into Harry and makes him, like, fall backwards in slow motion.
It's not exactly a soul. It's, like,
I believe it's his soul.
It's not his soul because his... Spoiler alert, it's obviously... His soul has been broken up into different
pieces. It's a piece of his soul.
So it's like less than a soul.
Yeah.
So he's less than human, less than a soul.
Yeah, exactly.
So it's just a vapor of just, like, an evil face.
Quirrell just vaped some Voldemort out.
Yeah.
But what's interesting is when Quirrell meets Harry... in the first act of the movie with Hagrid at that bar at the Leaky Cauldron, Harry puts out his hand to shake his hand, but Quirrell keeps his hands to himself, afraid to touch the boy.
Yeah, I wonder if he knew what would happen, but because obviously Voldemort doesn't understand love, which is why he's always making fun of Dumbledore in a way like, oh, is it love? Is that the secret weapon? Because it is. That's the secret weapon. I mean, Voldemort doesn't understand, Quirrell doesn't understand that the last act that Lily Potter did by sacrificing herself to save Harry Potter, even if she thought it was just going to be for a moment, that's what turned him basically into the ultimate weapon against the Dark Lord. The love of Lily Potter's sacrifice courses through Harry's veins. And then obviously in Goblet of Fire, Voldemort makes another mistake where he uses that love, that blood, and puts it in himself, which makes him more vulnerable later on.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that maybe Quirrell didn't shake Harry's hand. I would say maybe Voldemort was whispering to him not to because he didn't know if maybe it would reveal him at all, touching Harry.
Yeah, or maybe something would happen.
Yeah, like maybe his scar would start burning or something would happen if they actually touched. Obviously, he didn't know that they would break apart.
Because I don't think it's like that in the book, too, because I don't think he goes to shake his hand, or maybe he does in the book. I don't think that's a detail. And also, the way Quirrell dies is different in the book. He doesn't, like, completely turn to stone immediately like that. But I'm sure they did it for the film because of foreshadow the end.
But that's a pretty graphic thing to show in this kids' movie. It reminded me of a Spielberg, like Indiana Jones.
Well, Chris Columbus, his movies, yes, they're for kids, but they're also very mature in a lot of situations. I mean, think of Home Alone. Yeah, it's
so much gore.
If you think of Home Alone, like, oh, yeah, it's a fun kids' movie about some kid protecting himself from these thieves and robbers. It's intense. There's a lot of action.
The break-in sequence, the booby trap sequence, those are just messed up.
Yeah, it's a messed
up movie. Steps on the nail. Oh, my God.
It's pretty graphic.
There are moments that make you squirm.
Yeah. And the film has such a happy ending where Gryffindor upsets Slytherin for the house cup because Dumbledore kind of like... He kind of just like gives them like a thumbs up, like, yeah, I got you guys, and gives everyone... He gives Harry 50 points, he gives Hermione 50 points, he gives Ron 50 points, then he gives Neville Longbottom 50 points for... what's he say? It's like, it takes great bravery to stand up to your enemies, but even more courage to stand up to your friends. Something like that.
Put him over the edge.
So they end up beating Slytherin, which is awesome. He's like, it seems that a change in scenery is in order.
Remember the video game?
Yeah, it was epic.
That was a great game.
And then it ends with Harry getting on the Hogwarts Express to go back to London, and Hagrid gives him that photo album, which is such an important moment for Harry because now he can see his family, he can see his parents anytime he wants. And
it's like having his own mirror. Yeah, ever said
those moving photos, and he says, "I'm not going home, not really," which is very touching.
I'm not going home, not really,
because Hogwarts is Harry's home, just like Tom Riddle. FYI,
dun dun dun.
But I love this movie and every part of it. We could talk about it for like hours and hours. I'm sure we missed out on a lot of stuff, guys. Sorry.
Yeah. I don't know. This might be my favorite Harry Potter movie just because of the discovery aspect of it, of the world, learning the world, and just I adore this movie. It's a fantastic film.
Yeah.
Want to do some superlatives?
Let's do it.
Who's your MVP?
Danny Radcliffe. Let's go.
Nice. Great choice.
11-year-old carrying a multi-billion dollar franchise. Good job, kid.
Yeah. I chose Chris Columbus just for making a great establishing movie. What's the best scene?
Harry's first Quidditch match.
Ooh,
blew
great
my freaking
scene.
Mind.
That's
insane.
An awesome scene. I would say it's gotta be the arrival at the castle on the boats on the water. I think it's just unbelievable. Best shot. Wait, or Ollivander's when he gets the wand for the first time and you see, he's fucking magical. This is crazy. Best shot.
Harry getting his wand at Ollivander's when, it's because what's great about this film is, yes, it's magical, but there's so many practical magical effects and it's clever. And there are very few visual effects, obviously, like the bricks in the opening of Diagon Alley and the troll and stuff like that. But a lot of it's practical. That's why it feels so real and so fun.
Yeah, I'd say that's the best shot, too. It's a great camera movement. Change of lights and also the wind. It's just fantastic.
Yeah, so to create the wind, someone was just blowing in Daniel Radcliffe's face. That's a joke. That's not a real fact.
We'll make a TikTok clip about it.
To create the wind in Ollivander's shop, seven people off camera on set just blew into Daniel Radcliffe's face.
It worked. They were short money.
They spent all their hundreds of mils.
What's the best line of the movie?
It's actually just a minor monologue.
Oh, here we go.
It's Dumbledore.
Every time I say what's the best line, you do like a 3-minute monologue.
It's not true. Sometimes I just pick one or two lines. Dumbledore explaining to Harry why he survived when he was getting the Sorcerer's Stone. Your mother died to save. Should I do it in Voldemort's voice?
Please. Voldemort? You mean Dumbledore's voice?
If you want. I want it. It's going to be. I'm going to laugh too much. Your mother died to save you. If there's one thing Voldemort cannot understand, it is love. Love as powerful as your mother's for you leaves its own mark. To have been loved so deeply, even though the person who loved us is gone, will give us some protection forever.
That's a sweet pick.
Great line because it has so much to do with the future of the stories and Harry's, the reason why Harry survives and everything.
Yeah. My favorite line is, "You're a wizard, Harry." It's just great.
I thought a good one as well.
Most underrated aspect. I would say the production design because they didn't win the Oscar.
Yeah, that's insane. I mean, yeah, Moulin Rouge is great, but like, come on.
Yeah, go with that too.
Wardrobe.
Want to move on to some fun trivia?
Oh, we forgot Best Actor.
Oh, Best Actor.
I'm just going to talk about the trio. I'm giving it to Emma Watson because, she really carries the performances of the trio in this movie specifically, big time.
I'd say Best Actor is Richard Harris. He's perfect as Dumbledore, and I think that when he was gone, Michael Gambon did a very, very good job, but when he was gone, he was just very much missed by everyone.
It's hard to replace someone like that.
Want to move on to some trivia?
Let's do it.
All right. During the production of all of the Harry Potter movies, Daniel Radcliffe went through 160 pairs of glasses.
And even though in the books, Harry Potter is supposed to have the green eyes that Lily has, you look just like your father except for your eyes, you have your mother's eyes. Daniel Radcliffe tried to wear green contacts for the filming, but he's a very rare percentage of people who just can't wear contacts. It's extremely uncomfortable for him, so they just let him have his just natural blue eyes on camera, which is fine with me. It totally worked.
Emma Watson also tried to wear buck teeth because Hermione has buck teeth in the books, but it prevented her from speaking clearly, so she ended up not using the teeth. But at the end of the movie and during the celebration, it's a shot where she was wearing them, and so you can see Hermione with buck teeth in that shot.
I feel like I have buck teeth. I mean, represent the big teeth game.
We had buck teeth when we were kids, for sure.
Our front two teeth are just huge.
J.K. Rowling made up the names of the four Hogwarts houses while on a flight on a plane. She wrote them down on a barf bag so she could remember them. So she didn't even have a notebook with her.
Didn't she write basically like the kind of overarching story at a diner with her kid when she was in poverty on a napkin?
She got the first idea of Harry Potter while she was on a train. And she wrote down immediately, wizard kid, wizarding school, and a few other things. And then, you're right, on a napkin, she wrote down the overarching plot of good versus evil, basically.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure she was unemployed and on some sort of government assistance too, financially.
Yeah, she was on welfare. And her, I think her baby daddy was a bad guy, like an abusive guy. So she was just.
But his name was Tom Riddle.
So she was dirt broke and had a kid to try and support, and they were living on welfare government checks, and she wrote this novel while she was doing it.
There's actually an sorry.
No.
There's actually an extended cut of this movie that runs 159 minutes versus the theatrical version, which is 152 minutes. It was first shown on TV networks in ABC in the US and international broadcasts. It's also the 2009 limited edition, and there's some fun scenes that included in that, and including Dudley's uniform, where Aunt Petunia dyes Dudley's old uniform gray so Harry could use it in his school uniform, which is in the book. Also, the uniform is enormous. another scene that's in the book that was in this cut is Petunia opens A cards and starts cracking them, only to discover rolled up letters from Hogwarts addressed to Harry inside of them. Snape's class is just an extended version of that. On the train, Harry and Hagrid take the train to London, and Hagrid reveals his love for dragons. Finding Flamel, Harry, Ron, and Hermione discover Nicholas Flamel's name in a wizard card while looking for a counter-curse for Neville's leg locker curse. And Harry's meditation, Harry and Ron discuss more of the Mirror of Erised. So those are in the extended edition.
When Warner Brothers bought the rights to the books, they originally wanted to make the Harry Potter film franchise to be a set of computer animated movies like Pixar. And they also wanted to combine several of the novels. So they wanted to like maybe make 3 or 4 movies in total and have them be animated. But JK, because they didn't think that they would possibly be able to film it without the actors getting too old for their roles. But JK Rowling refused and wouldn't let them do this because, like I said earlier, she has final say on what's done with Harry Potter. And so they came up with the plan to shoot the films back to back to back to back and make them fast enough where the kids wouldn't age out. I think we all know that the book is actually called Harry Potter and the Philosopher's Stone, but in the U.S. it was changed to Sorcerer's Stone because the publisher felt that American kids wouldn't understand what like a philosopher is, because when we think of a philosopher, they're like, you know, like Socrates or something, like a thinker, whereas a philosopher in the U.K. is like a sorcerer. So they changed it for that reason, and J.K. actually regrets allowing them to change it to Sorcerer's Stone because she felt that it wasn't what she intended.
I've actually read the British version of one of the books, and that's how I learned that goose flesh means goosebumps.
Goosebumps, yeah.
In England.
Yeah. J.K. Rowling's full name is actually Joanne Kathleen Rowling, but she shortened her name to J.K. Rowling for the book out of fear that teenage boys would be unwilling to read a book written by a woman.
Columbus wanted a very elaborate welcome feast to match the description in the book, with roast beef, ham, turkey, all the trimmings. Every time I watch Great Hall scenes, I get starving, FYI. Unfortunately, filming under hot stage lights for countless hours, multiple days in a row, caused the food to develop unpleasant odors. Despite the meat being changed every 2 days and the vegetables twice a day, it still went rotten pretty fast.
99.9% of movies are filmed out of chronological order. Movies are produced based on scheduling, actor schedules, having sets and locations. So oftentimes, like, you'll see a movie and like they shot the climactic scene first, and like the first scene you see in a movie sometimes is shot like in the middle of a schedule or at the end of the schedule. So it's always filmed out of order. But this is a rare example of a film that was shot chronologically, and they did this because it was to help the actors, the kids, with their performances, because they felt it was kind of hard. It's hard if you're a little kid. Not only are you acting in a scene, but you have to pretend to know what happened in the scene earlier. Then that has to inform your performance in the scene currently. So they filmed it in an order so they could go, oh, I filmed this yesterday, so this is my next part to do.
Yeah, can you imagine like filming Radcliffe's scene with Quirrell at the beginning of production?
Yeah,
it wouldn't fit right.
Yeah, imagine that's your first scene is the end of the movie. That'd be crazy.
In Harry Potter and the Sorcerer's Stone, in the trophy cupboard to the right of the Quidditch trophy, you can see the service to the school trophy with part of Tom M. Riddle engraved on it.
This is when he does that thing in Chamber of Secrets we'll talk about next week. Before John Williams made the score for the entire film, he actually composed music for the trailer. Now, this is something he has only done once before, and he made a special exception for this film because he was so passionate about it. So the music you hear in the first trailer for Harry Potter and the Sorcerer's Stone is a completely separate piece of music from the score itself, and that actually contains the very first themes of the movies. When Chris Columbus pitched the movie to Warner Brothers, what happened was they heard pitches from hundreds of filmmakers who were all dying to direct the film. And Chris Columbus, he asked Warner Brothers if he could be the last pitch they had. So he wanted to be the very last pitch they heard. And so after, I think it was 5 weeks of hearing pitches, it was finally his turn. And in their meeting, in their pitch meeting, Chris Columbus spent 3 hours talking about exactly how he wanted to film the film to play out. He even showed footage of Daniel Radcliffe in the David Copperfield movie to show who would make a good Harry Potter. Author J.K. Rowling previously stated that the T in Voldemort is silent, as it is in the French word for death, mort. Voldemort literally means flight from death in French. Audio actor Jim Dale pronounced the T in the U.S. audiobooks before the release of the movie. After this, Dale changed his audiobook pronunciation accordingly. And we could go on and on, like, with movie facts about Harry Potter and the Sorcerer's Stone. So we're just going to wrap it up right there. Thank you so much for tuning into this episode. Be sure to go to patreon.com/Raiders of the Lost Podcast to become a patron today. Thank you so much to everyone who already is a patron. And hope you all have a great day.
See you next time.
Raiders of the Lost Podcast is a Mirror Image production. Sound mixing done by Jacob Kosler. Opening music by Chase Jackson. Thank you for watching Raiders of the Lost Podcast. Hit that subscribe button and notification bell. Listen to the audio formats of Raiders of the Lost Podcast on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, and wherever you listen to podcasts. New episodes every Monday and Thursday. Support us on Patreon at patreon.com/Raiders of the Lost Podcast.